Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
This is WTIC's Law Talk, a project of the Hartford County Bar Association. If you have a legal question, call now, 860-522-WTIC or 800-966-WTIC. And now, it's time for Law Talk on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Hi, everybody. Good afternoon. Welcome to Law Talk on a sunny Saturday afternoon. I am Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. Glad to be with you this afternoon. As with most Saturday afternoons, we are here from 3 until 4. This is part of WTIC's community service, and we're pleased to take your calls, your legal inquiries, your legal comments, put them on the air, see what we can do to help with them, react with them. And we do that by taking your calls at 860-522-WTIC, 1-800-966-9842. And we are here only until 4 o'clock, so enjoy the program. Sit back, listen, but if you're thinking about giving us a call, better to do it a little bit earlier than a little bit later. Wanted to mention also that if you'd like to email us, that's okay too. And the email address is john.matulis@entercom.com. That's john. My last name, Matulis, M-A-T-U-L-I-S, at entercom.com. Before we get started today, and before I let you know about the different topics that we've picked out to try to share some information with you, point out some takeaways from things going on in the courts, just wanted to say happy birthday to Steve Salhaney here at WTIC Entercom. Steve has put up with more stuff from more people for more years than anybody could ever expect. So Steve, from all of us, although sometimes it may not get said too often, happy birthday. Okay, so let me tell you what's going on today. In addition to calls from listeners or comments on matters legal in nature, we've got a bunch of different topics that I picked out. Some of these come from current court decisions because I think that they either address issues that may not be understood well or that there's a takeaway that is important for our listeners to hear about. Notwithstanding that, you got a question about something legal in nature, we'll be happy to hear that also. So once again, that's 860-522-9842, 1-800-966-9842. Okay, so let's take an example with a topic called grandparent visitation. And here is the story. Richard and Nancy have a daughter. And for purposes of this story, her name is Daughter. Daughter has a couple of children, and they are Richard and Nancy's grandchildren. Daughter's relationship with the children's father is horribly damaged, broken, appears to be irreparable. So much so, in fact, that Daughter and the two children have lived with Richard and Nancy for many, many years. As the older grandchild got to be a teenager, Nancy started suggesting to Daughter, you know, it would probably be a good thing for her to have a relationship with your father, with her father. And Daughter not only disagreed, she disagreed vehemently, and she disagreed so badly that she packed up the two kids, she moved out of Richard and Nancy's house, and she forbade them any visitation with the grandchildren. Well, you can imagine how Richard and Nancy felt. So they hired a lawyer, good lawyer. I happen to know these lawyers on both sides of this case. And they went to court in Hartford with a petition asking the court to provide them with some grandparent visitation. Okay. Now, those of you that are grandparents out there, or those of you that know grandparents that may be in a similar situation, there's a lot of misconceptions about how this works out. So let me tell you a little bit more about it and what happened here. Okay. The parents, the grandparents, Richard and Nancy, filed a petition with the court, and what they said in it was a whole bunch of different things, that they had basically provided child care, that the children lived with them during the entire time. During the preteen years, they took care of the kids so that the mother could obtain employment, that is, daughter obtained employment. They provided clothing, shoes, shelter, taught them life skills, took them on vacations, did homework, and facilitated them getting involved in sports activities. And when Nancy retired, she became the custodian for the kids, and she was responsible for getting them up in the morning, getting them breakfast, making sure homework was done, taking them to and picking them up from school, after school activities, feeding them, putting them to bed. The daughter has asthma. Many times they provided the asthma treatment with her. They occasionally brought her to the doctor and sometimes to the hospital. So they felt that it was in the children's best interest to maintain a consistent and ongoing relationship with them. Okay? Sounds very, very good, doesn't it? Well, even though daughter opposed this, the law is a little different. Okay, they filed this affidavit with the court, and daughter's attorney filed a petition, a motion to dismiss it, claiming that it did not touch all the bases necessary for the court to proceed further. Now, here's what the law says, and here's a couple of areas which have been very fertile areas for more arguments at court about this stuff. Okay, first of all, the parents have to show that they have the grandparents have to show that they have a relationship with the grandchild or the grandchildren that is parent-like. And then the second thing they have to show is that denial of the visitation sought causes, quote, real and significant harm to the child or children, close quote. Okay, wonderfully vague terms as they're posed right there. So what happened in this case? Well, daughter's attorney filed a motion to dismiss, and the attorney for Richard and Nancy said, well, we better beef up this affidavit that we filed in support of visitation. So they filed a motion to disclose an expert, a child psychologist, a very, very well-known child psychologist in family law areas, and he was going to testify at court, according to their disclosure, of the grievous harm that the children would suffer psychologically. And this was an effort to address the second prong of the two-pronged test. By the way, that two-pronged test goes back to a Supreme Court decision in Connecticut from 2002 called Roth versus Weston. And I think many people didn't realize just how severe a hurdle, how high a hurdle the Roth decision posed. Anyway, we're going to explain exactly what happened and why, but we're required to take a break at this point. So I just wanted to let you know that you are listening to Law Talk on WTIC News Talk 1080. I am Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. Not only will we tell you the rest of the story and what happened in this grandparent visitation case after the break, we will get to Tom in West Hartford with your call. Please stick with us. There's another one being posted, and we've got a couple of lines open, so we'd be happy to hear from you also. Once again, 860-522-WTIC. WTIC 1-800-966-9842. Law Talk continues after this.
All
right. Welcome back to Law Talk on WTIC and News Talk 1080. WTIC.com, streaming audio on the net. And if you take a look at radio.com, you can probably find us that way also. Okay, welcome back. I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. And we're in the middle of telling you a bunch of different stories about recent court cases. They either dispel some myths, they reinforce some misconceptions, but most of them have a takeaway. We've got one about grandparent visitation. We set the stage for it. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit more about it. Then we'll get to Tom in West Hartford with his question. And we've got a line open for you also at 860-522-WTIC, 1-800-966-9842. Okay. Grandparent visitation in Connecticut is tough. And in our story here, Richard and Nancy basically took daughter and her two kids in. They all live together. The grandparents, Richard and Nancy, did a tremendous amount for the kids. And then when they suggested to daughter that maybe the grandchildren should get to at least know their bio dad, daughter was so offended, she moved out, took the kids with her, and on top of that, she denied visitation. So they filed a petition with the court. Daughter's attorney moved to dismiss the petition, claiming it didn't spell out the grounds sufficiently for grandparental visitation. And the grandparents filed the disclosure of an expert witness, a clinical psychologist who was going to testify as to just how much these kids would suffer psychologically as a result of the deprival of the relationship with the grandparents. Okay. That's to address the second prong of the test, quote, real and significant harm to the children. Well, here's what happened. Number one, the court never allowed the expert witness to testify. And you think, well, why is that? I mean, doesn't the court want to get to all the facts so it can make the best decisions? Supreme Court decision basically places serious limits on the number of people that can testify in these specific matters. The second thing is that you would think if there's an argument about whether there was a parent-like relationship, that's prong number one, or whether or not there was real and significant harm, that that would be a question of fact and that the court would decide it after a hearing with testimony and evidence. Well, not so, because it turns out that the law says that they have to allege in their affidavit in support of their petition facts that are sufficient so that the court could conclude that the daughter is either an unfit parent or that the children's situation is so dire that it's akin to being neglected. So what happened was the motion to dismiss filed by daughter was granted. And in the face of all of this, Richard and Nancy appealed to the appellate court, and they released a decision at the end of January, and they basically upheld the child court. So before we get to Tom in West Hartford, the family court, before we get to Tom in West Hartford, let me just tell you what the takeaway is from this. You've probably seen this coming, and some of you may have encountered this previously. But number one, it is devilishly difficult for grandparents to obtain court ordered visitation with grandchildren. The two requirements are very, very strict. Number one, a parent-like relationship, which it sounds like Tom and Nancy had here, or pretty close to it. But the second one, that the deprival of the visitation would have to be akin to almost the child being neglected, or to prove that the custodial parent was unfit. Now, the third part of it, which we didn't mention yet, and which they didn't have to get to, makes it even worse. And that is that they have to prove all of this by what's called clear and convincing evidence. It's not the usual standard of proof. So what's the takeaway? The takeaway is that you probably should not get your hopes up if you are grandparents about getting court-ordered visitation over the objection of the custodial parent. Back when I used to do family law, we saw this periodically. We'd be representing, say, the father. The mother had visitation of the kids. Father's parents wanted to insinuate themselves into the case. Well, what about us? You know, you have to represent us too. I said, nope, no can do. So the takeaway is probably try to maintain the best relationship with the actual bio parents, because the cards are stacked against you in family court, and the law has to be applied and followed by the judges. So that is the story on that. Let's go to Tom in West Hartford. Hey, Tom, thanks for holding, and you're on Law Talk.
Okay, thank you very much for taking my call. I have a problem that has to do with landscaping. Last late spring or early summer, I had 10 plants installed in my yard, and at the time of the installation, all the plants were healthy, and they were thriving, and they did well. And I was instructed to water them regularly throughout the next several weeks, and I did that. And then a couple of months went by, and I noticed that about four of the plants were not thriving properly. Six were, four were not. And eventually, I called a landscaper, and he came over, and he said, well, the problem is that those four plants are under the canopy of a tree, and they're not getting enough sunlight, and that's the issue. And I said, oh, well, what can be done about it? And he says, well, not too much. And now I notice that with the cold weather, all 10 plants have shriveled. Now, it's bitter cold weather now, January and February, and I don't know whether any of the plants are going to recover for the month, warmer months in May. And I'm just wondering if I possibly have any recourse legally for reimbursement for part of the fee that I paid to the landscaper.
Okay, good question, Tom. Let me ask you this. This tree canopy that supposedly was causing the problems, yeah. I assume that was there when the landscaper came out, took a look at it, and gave you his proposal for the job, correct?
Absolutely.
So
right.
It would have been very, very difficult for somebody to miss that tree canopy, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Okay. Now, did you have a written contract with the landscaper?
I did.
And does it address the issue of any kind of a guarantee? Because some of them do.
I don't have it in front of me, and I
understood.
I don't think there is a guarantee. And I will say that at the time of the installation, all the plants were thriving, and I was directed just to water them, which I did, and eventually that problem cropped up. And I don't know if in the upcoming warm season I'm going to lose all 10 plants, not just the four under the canopy, but all 10, because right now they don't look healthy at all. But to answer your question, I don't think there was an absolute guarantee in the contract.
Okay, let's assume that there was not. The reason I ask is because there are some landscapers who will replace plants that that die, providing they've been properly cared for, because yeah. They plant them and they provide the adequate fertilization and soil and everything else to make sure they grow. But let's assume that's not the case here. Are we talking about plants which, by the nature, were terribly expensive?
Yes, they cost. The total job was, I think it was $2,900.
Okay, so these are significant. It's not something that you could go down to Home Depot and replace out of their plant section for $100 or something.
That's right.
Okay. I think that the best thing for you to do would be to contact the landscaper and say that for what I've paid for this and for the value of these plants, I'm very, very disappointed in the ones that died, and the rest of them aren't looking very well either. So I'm putting you on notice right now that if they don't come back in the warm weather, I'm going to expect some adjustment in what I've paid you. And I think the thing that you'll have to do is wait and see what happens in the spring. I know you've said that they don't look very well and it's bitterly cold, but not knowing the nature of the plants and not knowing much about plants, maybe these are plants that look terrible in the off season, but they come back to life beautifully in the spring. I just haven't got any idea.
Yeah, you're right. And I think they're supposed to be perennials, but rather than annuals. But you're right. You have to wait until the warm weather comes. And my other question is, if he's adamant in refusing reimbursement for any part of it, do you recommend that I contact an attorney? And if so, how would I go about getting an attorney?
Okay, I can certainly tell you how you can get an attorney. There's a couple of different things I can recommend, though. First of all, I think that right now you should send the landscaper something in writing, putting him on notice that you are very disappointed with how they're looking. And once the spring comes and the plants should be coming back to life and flourishing, you'll have a much better idea of the condition, and you'll be in further touch with him at that point. Most of these people, their reputations are pretty important to them. Second thing, the attorney basically is going to think in terms of, well, is there a breach of a contract here? Is there a breach of an implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose or some other legal concept?
Yeah.
That last one comes out of the Uniform Commercial Code. I think that the more practical approach would be to say, you know, you've got an internet presence, and I may very well decide to write some reviews that aren't flattering and just describe my experience. As long as what you put is true, even if it's not flattering, you're not going to get in trouble for it. And I think a lot of people in the position of a responsible vendor like that will say, well, let's see what we can do to try to make the gentleman happier. So I think those are a couple of ways to do it. Now, if you do decide that you'd like to hire a lawyer, the best thing to do, get some legal advice if you don't have a lawyer, try the lawyer referral service. Uh-huh. Get a half-hour consult. They'll go over that contract with you. They'll tell you what your rights are legally. And I'll give you the number where you can reach them.
Okay.
It's incredibly cheap. It's $35 for a half-hour consult.
Okay,
so here's the number, 860-525-6052.
Okay.
And I'm going to have to break right now. If there's anything further you wanted to cover, let me know and I'll leave you on hold. But we're breaking for news, and so I've got to wrap this one up.
Mr. Matulis, I greatly appreciate your advice. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you. Take care now.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, more of Law Talk after this. Indeed, that's what often happens. Hey, welcome back to Law Talk on WTIC News Talk 1080, WTIC.com, streaming audio on the net. If you have somebody that is not in the immediate listening area for this 50,000-watt AM radio station, but you think they might enjoy the program or participating, have them give us a listen on WTIC.com. Just hit Listen Live, and there you are. Also, if you want to call us, 1-800-966-WTIC, toll free in the continental U.S. Delighted to hear from you. We've got a couple of calls. We're going to deal with George in Lebanon shortly, Jim in Southington. There's a line or two open for your call at 860-522-WTIC, 1-800-966-9842. Before we get to the listeners, let me just remind you that if you do not have an attorney and you're looking for legal information, let me suggest the Hartford County Bar Association's not-for-profit lawyer referral service. It's a good deal. It's extremely inexpensive. And as you'll hear in a moment, I think it's a good alternative to any of the other ways that you might look for an attorney. Word of mouth is good, but geez, don't go with the billboard or whoever has the splashiest internet ad. Here's what you do. You call them up at the phone number that I'm going to give you in a moment. They'll ask you a couple of questions to determine the nature of your legal issue, and you will get referred to an attorney who is experienced, who is insured, who practices in the proper discipline to help you with your legal issue. So what do you get from that attorney? Well, you get a half-hour consult, and given the rates that experienced attorneys charge for their time, a half-hour is pretty substantial. The cost is a one-time-only fee of $35. And it goes to help underwrite some of the cost of running this not-for-profit program. There's administrative expenses, phones, offices, personnel, stuff like that. And at the end of the half hour, there's no hard sell. There's no further obligation on your part whatsoever. If you want further legal assistance, you and the attorney are free to discuss that. And if you agree to proceed together, that's fine. If not, you're done and that's the end of it. Now, they make it a little better for certain types of cases. If you're calling about your personal injury case, they will waive the $35 fee. If you're calling about your Social Security disability claim, ditto, no $35 fee. If you're calling about your workers' compensation claim, same thing. So this is a great way to get some advice, and whether it goes any further than that or not, entirely up to you, entirely within your control. That is the Hartford County Bar Association's not-for-profit lawyer referral service at 860-525-6052. That's 860-525-6052. I think you'll find it's a real good way to get what you need. Okay, so much for that. Let's go to the phones. George in Lebanon, hi, you're on Law Talk.
Actually, you've got Kate now because he's having difficulty hearing the phone.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, Kate, you're welcome. They had you up on the screen as George, so we're happy to talk to Kate.
It was George. Yeah, it was George. He's having difficulty hearing the phone, so he asked me to step in.
Certainly. Okay, so how can I help? I understand this has to do with a squatter and a trailer.
Yes. We own a piece of commercial property with a warehouse that has a couple of different groups operating from there. We have this person that used to be employed by one of the groups who was allowed to temporarily put a trailer on the property with the understanding that, you know, he was going to get it out of there. And he has moved into the trailer and has been living there for a rather lengthy period of time. The town, as they often do, has gotten involved, and because it's not a residential property, they would like to have this person removed and have given a deadline to do so before they start imposing fees.
We had
contracted an attorney and gone through the process necessary to evict a person with no success. We have gone down the road two or three times, most recently gone through the process with a judge. We felt that everything was in order and that the judge would order this person to leave, but that did not occur. So we are now faced with penalties from the town, and no idea what to do to remove this person, who is now also breaking into the building, stealing electricity, stealing scrap metal to sell, and availing himself of the facilities and whatnot.
Wow. Okay, so several different aspects to this. First of all, this is a hybrid type of case because the housing laws, the landlord-tenant laws, typically contemplate either residential or commercial. And what you've got here is somebody who is, it's well put on the screen here, was a squatter. So let me ask you, what happened at court? You mentioned that the judge did not rule in your favor, but was there an actual decision made, or what happened at court?
Not really. Went to court. Everything was presented. We expected the judge to make a decision one way or another, and we're basically still left in limbo, that the judges did not find in our favor and did not order the person evicted. But so
when you have a hearing at court, the judge has to deal with that affirmatively. They're either going to grant the relief that you're looking for, or they're going to deny that relief. But they have to do something, and it has to be tangible, and there has to be a record of it, and there are supposed to be reasons for it. So did your lawyer explain to you why it is that you weren't able to get rid of this person?
Not at this time. We're waiting to hear back from him. This is very recent.
Oh, okay. How long ago did this matter conclude at court?
A week ago Friday.
Oh, okay. Now, even though it's supposed to be a summary process, meaning quick, sometimes it takes a while, especially if the judge has to write a decision. And like I mentioned, this is sort of a hybrid case. It's a little bit unusual. So I think at this point, what you can do, unless your lawyer has in some fashion conducted himself or herself in a way that you don't think that your best interests are being served, ask them to find out from the clerk when they might be able to expect a decision. Some judges, it takes much longer than others. But if this was a week ago Friday, it's well within the period of time when a judge is permitted to write a written decision. So the mere fact that you didn't get what you want yet doesn't necessarily mean you're not going to. So I think that would be the best starting point. Other than that, you need to contact the police about the theft of the personal property. You mentioned scrap metal. Theft of electricity is a criminal offense also. And do not let the police tell you, well, it's a civil matter because you're in court with them. This is still a criminal matter. And if you're in housing court, it's limited to the question of possession of the premises and not questions like money or things of that nature. But theft of utilities is a criminal matter, and certainly theft of scrap metal or things of that sort. Those are criminal matters.
Yeah, we have also gone to the expense of installing video to document that.
Well, I think you're going to be able to present the police and ultimately the courts a very, very strong case of what's going on here. But do not allow them to say that, well, it's a civil matter, because theft of utilities is not, nor is theft of scrap metal. The scrap metal belongs to you or to George or to somebody?
Belongs to one of the businesses on the premises.
Okay. Well, the owner of the scrap metal is the party who has the right to complain to the police, but that's a criminal offense, and the person needs to be arrested for that. Very interesting case, though. Give us a call in a future show and let me know how it turns out, okay?
Will do. I certainly appreciate your help, and you've given us some things. At least we can feel like we're doing something.
Excellent. Well, all the best with that. I hope it works out well. Thanks for the call.
Thank you so much.
Okay, take care now. Okay, wow, interesting case there. Our phone number is 860-522-WTIC, 1-800-966-WTIC. Jim in Southington will get to you shortly, although we're going to have to take a break, and I think that we're probably going to just do a tidbit here on landlord-tenant, take the break, and then Jim will be first up. After that, we've got room for a caller or two, and at 4 o'clock, we disappear and we'll no longer be able to help out. So it's 860-522-9842. 1-800-966-WTIC. Just a couple of other pieces of landlord-tenant stuff, which I think is good to mention. First, for commercial tenants, okay? If you have a business and your business is being evicted, be aware that unlike in residential evictions, the landlord has the right to ask the court that you forfeit your personal belongings to him, her, or it as part of the eviction. So that's just something I wanted to pass along in the commercial setting that was suggested by the phone call that we just had. Okay, now, if you are a commercial landlord, okay, and you go to evict your tenant, you have to make absolutely certain there are no subtenants or sublessees or someone else also occupying the premises or doing business from those premises. If there is, or even if you think there may be, make sure they are named in the notice to quit. Make sure they are named in the complaint for the summary process action. Because if they're there and you don't name them and you go ahead and get an eviction, a judgment for a possession of the premises, it applies to them, except they have the right to come into court and ask to be found exempt. And then there's a hearing, and the burden is on the landlord to show that you either didn't know they were there or that you wouldn't have known in the course of reasonable care that they were there. So it can delay things tremendously. If they're successful in getting the exemption, you've got to basically go back and rejigger the whole case, make them a part of it, serve them a notice, serve them a complaint. It's a great way to spend a lot of extra money and a lot of extra time. So those are a couple of points concerning commercial evictions, one for the landlord, one for the tenant. We're going to have to take a break. We'll get to Jim in Southington and your call, and we'll do all of that right after this. Okay, welcome back to Law Talk right here, WTIC News Talk 1080, WTIC.com, streaming audio on the net. I am Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association with you up until 4 o'clock today on these Saturday afternoon get-togethers where we dispense legal advice, legal information, and try to help you navigate your way through that thicket of laws and rules and regulations that we're all expected to comply with one way or another. Let's go to the phones. Jim in Southington, you've been very patient. Thanks for holding, and you're on the air.
Hello, John. Good afternoon. My question has to do with some vinyl replacement windows that I had installed approximately 3 years ago now.
Uh-huh.
The windows, you know, there's a guarantee or a warranty on the windows themselves. I believe it's 20 years. And the window frames, after 3 years, have gotten really faded on the sun side of my house. So when I call the local installer, you know, he says, well, geez, I really need to talk to the manufacturer. And then I called, you know, it's a well-known manufacturer, and I called them. And they were quick to point out that after I sent them pictures that the fading, they're saying, is caused by environmental issues. And there's no warranty on that, but you know, I think I consider, although it's a broad term, environmental issues, I kind of didn't think it was going to be because of sun exposure, just because sun's out all the time. So before I call the attorney referral service, if you think it's worth it, I just wanted to ask your opinion on, you know, 3-year-old new windows, you know. This is a $12,000, you know, installation for all the windows. And do you think there's any worth of me contacting a lawyer or anything?
Yeah, I do, Jim, and here's why. Especially if you still have the paperwork that was signed at the time that you agreed to this job. I'm sure there was a contract or a purchase order or something of that nature. And depending on the manufacturer, whom you described as a well-known manufacturer, probably some marketing materials in which they praised their product and their reputation and all that stuff, right?
Yes, yes, and okay. I have the paperwork, and yes, you are right, it does.
Yeah, so I think the best thing to do would be to take that paperwork. I think you should consider making an appointment with a lawyer referral service, and when they hook you up with an attorney, see if the attorney wants to see the stuff ahead of time before the two of you actually speak, because that will give him or her an opportunity to look into it in a little more detail, and you get a little more bang for your half-hour buck.
Okay.
But you may very well have some rights there. The trouble is that they seem to be fading just on one side and not on any of the others. I mean, this is foreseeable, and I wouldn't be surprised if something in their marketing materials made some representations about it. Are there other people on the street whose houses are aligned towards the sun, pretty much similar to the way that yours is, Jim?
I tell you, John, that, you know, after I had mine installed, several people have had installed windows. And they are aligned, but mine are brown windows, and theirs are white windows. And
I see.
You know, the white doesn't show the fading as much as a brown type.
Yeah, window, so. I see what you mean. Well, even though we all know the sun can be a powerful detrimental force there, New England. It's the Northeast. Just wondering what those same windows would be like in southern Florida or, you know, Phoenix or someplace like that where they'd get really baked.
Yes, myself too. So.
Yeah, is this a national manufacturer who's likely to be selling in those markets also?
I believe, yes, it's a well-named window for sure.
Yeah, the ones that are really reputable will sometimes try to stand behind the product. I thought at first that you had a question about the installation itself, but it sounds like the installation was satisfactory. It's the product itself that's not holding up.
Correct. And again, the glass portion of it, and actually the glass from the manufacturer is guaranteed for 20 years, you know, the double pane and, you know, the seal in between it and stuff like that, 20 years. And then the local manufacturer goes further and says that the lifetime, they give a lifetime warranty. But it's the frame, you know, it's the actual color of the frame where it's exposed to the sun, I guess.
Yeah, I think it'd be a good idea to have an attorney review those documents and see if they gave you either an express or an implied warranty that might cover the fading. And the other question is, the fading is an aesthetic or an appearance issue, but is it having any effect on the structural integrity of the frame itself also?
That's
I don't know
true.
What's going on with that.
It could. You know, they did tell me the purchase like this... this product that you apply to decks, vinyl decks. And I actually did apply it to one or two of the windows, and it works pretty good. It works pretty good to shield or to change the color back to its original. So they know of the issue, I guess. And,
yeah, it sounds like it's not their first rodeo.
Yes.
Okay, but I wish you the best with it, Jim, but see what you can get from a lawyer who's had the chance to look at the actual paperwork and the contract and especially some of their marketing materials. There are a couple of ways to deal with them short of hauling them into court that may be helpful also, and a lawyer that is familiar with some consumer issues may be able to help you out in that way also.
Okay, John. Well, thank you so much. I certainly have the attorney referral number, but feel free to repeat that again for everybody.
Okay, I certainly will.
At your leisure.
And thanks for the reminder. It's 860-525-6052.
John, thank you again for your opinion on this. I appreciate it.
Best of luck with it, Jim. Hope it works out.
Thank you.
Okay, take care now. All right. Well, different little issue there that hopefully will be helped out with somebody who can look at the actual contract and the marketing materials. That is an important thing for anyone who's trying to determine their legal rights. So if you happen to be in a situation like Jim, start looking for that stuff, and hopefully you can dig that out, because there may be express warranties that have been made in there, and there may be certain implied warranties that may give you some relief also. But without seeing the materials, can't do it over the air. You know, we were talking a little bit before about landlord-tenant issues, and we talked about a couple of issues in the commercial setting. There's a tidbit that I want to share with you in the residential side. We have a lot of listeners that are landlords. Some of them own two or three family houses. Others own more substantial sets of residential property. We have a lot of listeners that are tenants. But here's something that everybody needs to know. It has to do with security deposits, okay? A word for you landlords, if you're thinking of renting to a person and you have reason to believe that they are or may be over 62, find out. And don't be too concerned about inquiring into their privacy or something. And here's why. The law says that you are permitted to charge up to 2 months of security deposit for a rental unit, a residential rental unit, except, and here's the exception, if the tenant is 62 years of age or over, then it's a smaller amount, and I believe it's 1.5 months. Now, that doesn't sound like it's a very big issue, but it is illegal to charge a security deposit that exceeds what is permitted by law. And if down the road somewhere, there's some kind of landlord-tenant spat and one side or the other is in court, you don't want to find the tenant raising issues or, worse yet, counterclaims that an illegal security deposit was extracted from them as a condition of renting the unit. So just something to pass along on both sides. If you are a tenant and you give the appearance that you may be at or above age 62, if the landlord either asks you or has you fill out some paperwork that indicates that, that's the reason for it. It's basically to allow the landlord to comply with the law, which is intended to favor you and people in a similar position. So that is pretty much the little bit on landlord-tenant law for today. We did not get to talk about access to Connecticut beaches on Long Island Sound. That's a real hot-button issue, and we will do that in the next program, okay? Meantime, time for me to say my thanks. Thank you all for listening. Thanks especially to those of you who have called in, because by doing so, you allow us to help you and others who are listening. Thanks to Joe, my producer. He is the sterling young man whose voice you hear when you first call in here at the radio station. And it's time for me to say, we'll see you next week. So until then, it's Attorney John Matulis, and take care. See you then.
Law Talk is presented as a public service by the Hartford County Bar Association. Its content is intended to be educational and informative, but is not considered to be formal legal opinion. If you want or need a formal legal opinion upon which to rely in decision-making, please consider formally engaging an attorney to review all relevant facts in detail and examine the pertinent law as it applies to those facts. A solid opinion means better decisions. The views expressed during this program are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the Hartford County Bar Association, its officers, or its directors. We'll be right back.